College football summer is no time to slouch because we are taking you to school on the Cover 3 podcast, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. It's time for our annual summer school series as we take time to break down some of your favorite teams with experts and insiders who know these depth charts from top to bottom. But summer school is just extra credit as we go through positional drafts, player rankings, and more. Follow and listen to the Cover 3 podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Folks, one of the favorite segments of my week is the NOLA Coalition segment. You've heard me say this probably 100 times now. The difference makers in our community, down in the trenches, doing a lot of the hard work that needs to be done. But there's a huge return on the investment. And the folks that are just really paying attention to these challenges that, you know, the city, and this is not a knock on the city, but this is anywhere. They don't have the assets or resources to deliver a lot of these services. We rely on the not-for-profit community to backfill and to do so. And today's no different. Kay Usen, Executive Director of Mission Rebirth, joins us. Kay, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Good morning. How you doing?
Good morning. This is kind of an appropriate conversation this morning in light of a lot of what's happening in the city right now. Kay, tell us about the mission of Mission Rebirth.
So our mission basically is I wanted to provide supportive services to our reentry, which reentry could just be justice involved, where maybe you got in trouble for DUI, had probation, or it could be those that did a lot of time in incarceration, and then our vulnerable communities. A lot of the homeless population also have some type of justice involvement as well. So I wanted to provide resources as a one-stop shop type of thing to get them to self-sufficiency. I kind of felt like the dots were not connecting with the resources they needed in order to be successful and reduce recidivism.
The truth be told, there are a lot of resources out there, but sometimes they're difficult to get to without a gatekeeper, right?
The biggest thing is a lot of times they don't know how to advocate for themselves, or they're not educated as far as how programs work, or the wait times on some of the programs, or just, you know, just how it goes all together. A lot of times they're caseworkers that they've had in the past have like maybe lost trust with them, or they just don't understand the processes. So we kind of help them with navigating through the processes while educating them for future. And we're lifelong case managers for them, so we don't discharge them after we do whatever service they initially come in for.
With those that are justice involved, and I actually, when I was sheriff, supported a number of reentry programs because I thought that assimilation process, especially those that had served a lot of time, was a difficult period of time. And what you did not want was individuals succumbing to the temptations that put them there in the first place, that you wanted them to experience the high of their family, the high of their children, the high of their Lord, if that's a path that they're going to walk on. What do you see as the biggest challenges today for your folks that are coming out that are justice involved?
There's two big challenges that I see. The first one, again, is they're not educated on how it works. A lot of times they, you know, there's so many, I want to say rumors, that, you know, oh, when you get out, you're going to get a stimulus check, or, oh, when you get out, you can get Social Security for PTSD. Oh, when you get out, they got a housing program where you're going to go straight to housing upon coming home. And so, or even with food stamps, you know, you're going to get out and you're going to get emergency food stamps because you were incarcerated. So I think the expectation is they're just going to hit the ground running, and they're not educated as far as what the barriers really look like or how the programs really work. So I think that is the first disconnect. The second one, I think, is access to resources. A lot of the nonprofit agencies, they either are understaffed due to some of the funding not covering operational expenses for staffing, or there's not a lot of program budget money out there that's allotted to, like, smaller nonprofits to help with like bus passes or work uniforms or, you know, just the small things that they may need just to get them started. So I feel like those are the two biggest disconnects or hurdles that they run into initially.
I found that a lot of the folks that we ended up working with, they especially those that had served a significant amount of time, that they really wanted to assimilate, but the difficulties, as you said, of connecting the dots, not having transportation, getting an ID, a driver's license, that was a challenge. There were a lot of different things that were challenges for them, especially those that didn't go into a step-down facility on their way out. They didn't have the benefit of that. We relied, and I actually supported a number of the not-for-profits, but we relied on the not-for-profits to do so because there really wasn't a lot of state or local agencies that provided any of this. And what kind of caught my eye with your program is that usually the case management process goes in snippets of time, right? Once you achieve certain things, it kind of goes away. But connecting the dots and the challenge to do so as you assimilate back into society doesn't doesn't go away, that challenge, right?
Correct. So we have a case management system here that I like to utilize. So when they come in, I do like a 5-10 minute assessment with them, no matter what service they come in for. So if they come in here for, say, food stamps, I do an assessment and I might find that you need shelter, you need housing, you don't have an ID, you're looking for work, and you only came in here for that one thing and I'm able to assist you with 7 things. So, you know, a lot of times they don't know what all they need because they may not have a support system or, like you said, good case management from whoever they were with previously. So that is a good thing to have. And if they don't know today, you know, they, like I said, as a lifelong case manager, they can call me 3 months from now and just say, hey, do you help with this? And we're able to still assist them. I think sometimes what may be the difference is a lot of agencies work off grant funding where it's a certain budget that you have to go by that only covers X, Y, Z. A lot of ours have been, you know, contractual type things or donations. So we're able to kind of be a little flexible with what I'm able to assist with depending on our funding without being so restricted.
The other thing that's interesting, and as you go through the employment process, a lot of vital documents about you, your Social Security card, your birth certificate, maybe you finished high school diploma, many have, their GED. They have to provide evidence of all of that. They don't have it anymore. They don't know where it is. Their families have moved away. Their stuff got thrown away. And then just going about getting all of that, it can be a huge hurdle as well.
Correct. So we do make sure to get that because I worked for Unity for a couple years doing the housing process for permanent housing. And I, you know, partner with a lot of other agencies to kind of see what their requirements are for the funding they have for housing and other supportive services that they may can partner to provide for us. And so we do provide help to get their IDs, birth certificates, and have it sent here. Because keep in mind, that population a lot of times don't even have a good address to mail things to for their vital documents. So we do like, we let them mail it here. We do IDs every Wednesday. I meet them at the DMV to pay for their IDs, and then we kind of assist them with whatever housing paperwork or job application paperwork. Like I said, we really walk them through every step while teaching them and not enabling them at the same time.
And the ultimate goal with the justice-involved individuals is that so they don't recidivate, right, and they become self-sufficient.
Correct.
And can provide for themselves. I mean, that I'm assuming. You tell me, that's your ultimate goal, right?
Yeah, that is definitely the ultimate goal. And what started me on the path of adding so many services, because when I first started, I literally was only doing like food stamp applications and resumes and that kind of thing. Then we had Hurricane Ida happen where it became more housing and shelter. And then when I worked for Unity during the COVID initiative, I noticed, you know, you see a lot of drug addiction to cover the mental health stuff. And you learn about, you know, you can't go to a shelter without a COVID test, but there was no COVID testing sites outside of the shelter. So how are they going to get there? Or if you don't have a phone with a GPS, how do you know where to go? So I started to, that's when I first started to realize the dots don't connect. And so I feel like if you can't get food stamps and you have to eat, what are you going to do to get money? You know, even on a basic level, you know, if you can't pay your fines, you know, those that, you know, do crime or sell drugs, like, why would they not go to that to pay their fines or to have a, get a hotel for the night instead of sleeping on the streets? Or, you know, it could be the smallest reason as far as them going back.
Yeah, and it could be just one little nuance that creates this house that has the house of cards come tumbling down, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and if you can accommodate that, it makes all the difference in the world. At least that's been my experience in working with that population. Kay Houston, thank you so much for joining us. Best of luck to you. If somebody wants to volunteer, help out, inquire, they may have some interest in your program, how would they contact you?
So everything you can do on our website is Mission Rebirth. missionrebirth.com. You can make appointments there. You can send me an email for volunteer work there. You can donate there. Everything is there. Also, our Instagram is mission.rebirth or at mission.rebirth. Facebook, Mission Rebirth as well. So, yes, thank you so much for interviewing me today and allowing me to join you guys. And I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Kay Houston, for all that you do. We appreciate you as well. Have a great week. Thank you so much.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, when we come back after the break, we will visit with Liz Murrell, the Louisiana Attorney General, and we'll be talking about this jail maintenance worker case. It looks like her office had a role in putting that case together, and we'll find out more when we return. Stay with us.
College football summer is no time to slouch because we are taking you to school on the Cover 3 podcast, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. It's time for our annual summer school series as we take time to break down some of your favorite teams with experts and insiders who know these depth charts from top to bottom. But summer school is just extra credit as we go through positional drafts, player rankings, and more. Follow and listen to the Cover 3 podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by the Attorney General for the state of Louisiana, Liz Murrell. General, welcome to the show. General, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Hang on one second. Okay, good.
Welcome to the show. Breaking news, a jail maintenance worker was arrested, accused of helping the inmates. I think your office has been involved in that investigation. Tell us about it.
Well, so last night we executed an arrest on an individual who is, in fact, a maintenance worker, or was a maintenance worker at the facility. You know, our information that we've put together indicate that he had been turning the water off to that pod, and which obviously contributed greatly to their capacity to do what they did. Had they, you know, cut that pipe, it would have flooded the cell. And so that facilitated these actions pretty heavily.
So this wasn't a one-off. He turned the water off more than once to allow them to finish the job and accomplish what they were doing in order to be able to escape.
That's my understanding.
So he's a lot more complicit than the story that he's telling, that he was threatened to be shanked. He actually went back on more than one occasion to do so. This is troubling.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, it will leave that his explanations for why he did it up to his lawyers and the legal process, and he'll certainly have an opportunity to try and show that or explain that, and to the extent that it, you know, addresses the violations at all or is relevant. But at the end of the day, you know, I mean, anytime someone, just assuming for the sake of argument that everything he said is true, you know, it begs the question of why did you keep going back? You know, well, I mean, if I'm being threatened by somebody with my, you know, my life, it seems to me I would avoid contact with that individual.
Yeah, and I would report it, right?
Well, there's there are a million other things you might do. We could go on with
I might want to know they've asked me to turn the water off, you know, which is not typically what an inmate's request is, to turn water off.
Right. You know, usually, it's a toilet. So, like, they were literally turning the water off to the pod, not the, you know, to the cell that these individuals needed to use. And so, you know, I think there are a lot of things going on here. I mean, that's the most recent thing that we have is this arrest last night. We also recovered the whole team that's out there working on the inmate, the escape recovery pod is, you know, still diligently working on that. They did recover another individual yesterday. And that is, you know, really headed up by state police and U.S. Marshals and some other law enforcement agencies. But there's a lot of moving pieces here, and I'm looking kind of at all of them.
So what he was doing while they were doing this, you know, because I got a text here, you can only cut a water line once. That wasn't the point. He was actually turning the water off in order to make so that in case while they were breaking through the wall, in case they did impact the water line, that they didn't run the risk of water running all over the place is what.
Yeah, I mean, and I actually, you know, don't have probably that level of detail available to me yet. I know that, you know, he did turn off the water. I think that, you know, this obviously was a project that took more than one night. And if they had cut that line, it would have flooded the cell. And so, you know, it is my understanding that, you know, I mean, I reserve the right to correct myself later, but I mean, my understanding is that this went on more than once over a period of time.
So let's pivot real quick to the scope of your investigation. The governor's been sending a number of investigations your way here lately. What is the scope and what's your intention relative to this investigation?
Well, and you know, just to be clear, like I sent people in Friday afternoon as soon as I knew about this, because I believed right off the bat that it was not appropriate for the sheriff to conduct a criminal investigation into her own agency. And I think that OP, the Orleans Parish Police Department, also, I did not think was just the right agency to do it, but they were also very, very much involved in responding to the actual escape. And so their resources, state police resources, everybody was busy addressing the escape with the boots on the ground. And that's the most important thing at that moment. And it still is our top priority. Meanwhile, we needed to have investigators that were immediately inside the prison and starting to talk to people. And so delaying that process, I thought right out of the gate would be, you know, bad for the overall investigation. And I directed my investigators to head over there. And so they were there Friday afternoon by around, I think, 2 or 3 o'clock. And we started talking to people. I will say the sheriff, you know, was cooperative from the beginning. And she is cooperative now. And I think, you know, the investigation shows what it shows, and she accepts that. I mean, that we need to get to the facts, and we need to understand not only who was directly complicit, but what other factors are contributing to this event occurring. And there are other factors that are contributing. I mean, we have the direct complicit involvement with an escape, but we also have a lot of other things that were in play that made it conducive, the environment conducive for this to happen.
Yeah, and I know the governor mentioned in his press conference that he wanted DOC to conduct an investigation as well as it relates to prison guidelines. Is that something that your office will participate in as well?
Well, DOC, and they're in the best position to do it. But so I think DOC is going to send a team in. I believe they started today, this morning. to come in and audit policies and procedures at the prison, audit the physical facility, and look at some of the issues that the sheriff has pointed to related to locking mechanisms on swinging doors, sliding doors. You know, she raised an issue with me specifically about when the building was built, metal flashing being put into the window, you know, the windows that inmates can remove from the window flashing and use as a weapon. You know, these are kinds of things that I think need to be evaluated by the state audit team. And, you know, there are federal monitors who've been in this prison. To my knowledge, they haven't really focused on those things. They have focused on staff levels, you know, inmate, the ratio of staff to inmates, other potential things like whether they're actually doing bed checks and how often do they do inmate counts and things like that. I mean, I think all of that is relevant to the audit that will be conducted by the DOC officials. And it is relevant to what I'm doing, but it is not, I won't be conducting that piece of it. They will, and I think they're the right ones to do it because they are the professionals who run prisons.
When you look at the breakdown and whether or not, you know, the appropriate protocols were in place and thus for and things of that nature, it seems to me that you're going to be caused to bring a lot of this investigative details from other investigations together in order for you to make a judgment, really, in this case, as to where the ultimate breakdown was, you know, whether or not this is... there's some intentionality involved here, whether or not there were shortcuts taken, whether or not security was sacrificed or otherwise. Because there, as you pointed out several times already in this interview, there's a lot of pieces and parts floating around and a lot of balls to juggle.
Look, I can tell you right now, there are going to be multiple factors that contribute to continuing issues at that jail. And, you know, I was watching this council meeting that's going on right now and, you know, listening to this kind of discussion about the difference between this being a prison and a jail. And, you know, quite frankly, those aren't terms that I think most people have thought much about. I think most people, including myself, when you say prison and you say jail, you think it's the same thing. But as a technical matter, they're not the same thing. And it does kind of relate to what you consider that facility to be used for. And so what we have there are people who are being held there for years at a time. And some of them are pretty violent, you know, accused of very violent crimes. And that is not necessarily what they designed that facility for. And so we need to take a look at those things. And I'm looking right now at solving, you know, for some particular issues that I think are going to help us make sure that the facility is secure and properly staffed. That means we've got to reduce the number of people that are in that jail. So how do we do that? You know, I mean, the federal monitors have looked at that. They've been going back and forth with the city council over things like that. They're building a new building, which they can't staff. You know, so I think there are a lot of things that the state needs to be engaging on and kind of coming to the table to, you know, I think we're entitled to have an opinion about it, certainly after what just happened.
No, no doubt. But you will recall in a not too distant past that model relative to the facility was a hybrid. It was a jail, and it was a prison because they actually housed state inmates for a long period of times, you know, and under a contract with DOC. So it has been a hybrid for decades now.
I think we've got to look at that. That's part of what they'll look at.
Yeah, I worked in one of those facilities in the late 70s. We were a hybrid then because we were housing state inmates back then.
Yeah,
had
look,
a strong desire
I, you know,
to increase
I
the number that we housed.
About, and they do because they get paid more from the state for it. And I, you know, I think that, you know, right now we've moved all DOC prisoners. And the only, I think once there were only about 60 there. We moved those over the weekend from that prison. And, you know, we're looking at other kind of issues. I looked at the court system. You know, I'm asking, we have just the Crime Commission just released a report showing an enormous backlog of cases with certain dockets And, you know, one judge in particular, I think, had a 700 case backlog. I'm told that 400 of those individuals are being held in custody at that prison. That's between a third and a fourth of the entire prison population.
Yeah, one judge.
That's unbelievable. That one metric is really kind of stunning to me, that one judge's docket could account for that much of the population at the jail. And some of that docket goes back to 2016. So, you know, I think that's a real problem. And I know that the Louisiana Supreme Court is starting to look at that issue. I'm, you know, going to be engaging more with them on some of those issues, because we need to look at how to right size the population at that prison. I mean, we've run into this issue during the Super Bowl and other things when we were calling and Mardi Gras saying, how much room do you have? We need to make sure, because we're getting ready to have these big events and, you know, people get arrested and they have to be booked and they might take a day or two even to get a hearing on bail. And, you know, you've got to be able to manage that situation properly on a long-term basis, not just in the short term. So I'm going to be looking at kind of short-term, immediate crisis recommendations, intermediate-term recommendations, and long-term recommendations. And I'll be talking to everybody that touches this prison for my report.
I know historically you're not wild about consent decrees, and I'm not sure that I am either. Obviously, there's one here, one that could be a very important tool to be used in compelling certain things to happen. Will you have a discussion with Judge Afric, who is, I think, the special master in charge of the consent decree for the jail?
Yeah, so he's the federal judge over the case. Magistrate North is the magistrate over it, and then there's a monitor, a lead monitor. You know, so they've been doing this since 2013, at least, when Judge Afric took over. We started that conversation yesterday, so the answer is yes, we will be engaging with Judge Afric. But, you know, here's one of the things that kind of concerned me, and I saw the counsel suggesting that we should ask the court to issue orders. Why do we need to ask a federal court to issue orders on things that we should be doing anyway? Like, we don't need a federal court to tell us to do the right thing. We just don't. And the problem with these consent decrees is that everybody starts relying on the federal judge to tell them to do something that they already know they need to do. That's what annoys me about the whole system. It gets bureaucratized and everybody's transferring responsibility to this judge. He's not a bad judge. He's actually a good judge. I've known him for a long time. And I think that he'd like to get this case to be over. But they keep kind of getting in their own way. And when the counsel itself is suggesting that the court should issue orders to tell them what to do, you have a problem, a misunderstanding about what the role of the court is and what their responsibility is. And, you know, are there other things that he could do that can help? I think so, yes. And so I'm not discounting the possibility that there may need to be some federal court orders that can come into play in this situation. But what's going to help him more than anything is all of us looking at that prison and making sure that we can get it to run right and not leaving it to him to figure out how to make that happen.
Yeah, you know, I mean, what happens here, and you've seen it, I mean, we have competing ideologies, we have competing priorities, we have limited assets, and this whole process gets caught up in this blender of the ideology and the priority. And we try to be all things to all people, and we can't. We just don't have the assets and resources to do it. And it's kind of why I like the way the governor laid it out as to the three-legged stool, that you're only as good as the other legs.
I saw one thing about like a dispute over how's the money being used. That ought to actually be pretty transparent. Like this, if the council wants the sheriff to have her finances in the BRAS system, which is a city, you know, tracking system for finances. That seems, you know, I believe in financial transparency. I think that everybody's obligated to tell. We're obligated as public officials to explain to everybody how we spend our money. We don't get to keep that a secret. It's not our money. It's taxpayer money. So, you know, to me, that's sort of a no-brainer. That ought to be something we ought to be able to fix immediately. But I'm just wondering why that wasn't done before.
Independently elected official that has financing from other independently elected officials. And
yeah,
it's
and
a pissing
so say
contest.
You don't get your money until you put your...
I'm going to get in the gutter and say what it is. It's a pissing contest. That's all it is. And you know,
yeah, but it's not.
But
one,
I'm like you.
It's not one that people are incapable of addressing. Like if the council wants her to participate in that system, they can condition giving her money on participating in that system. You know, actually, the federal court could assist with that as well. I mean, to me, this is a solvable problem. It's not one that should be continually. We should continue to be going back and forth. The legislative auditor can cut off funds to any state agency that's getting them if we aren't complying with the audit procedures of the state. It's not hard. I don't see why that is something that would continually be battered back and forth.
I think they may have achieved getting an audit actually completed here recently, but they went a number of years without an audit. They couldn't put together the financials to get one done. And if you check with the legislative auditor, I think he will confirm that.
I mean, I guess to me, that's the kind of thing that just sometimes, you know, everything gets delayed. I don't know what that, you know, whether it was the legislative auditor or it was their outside auditor, a lot of local political subdivisions, and this is a local political subdivision, permitted to hire their own auditor, and then their own auditor might delay things. You know, we've seen that with, say, Madison Parish Hospital up in North Louisiana, and when the audit doesn't look good for you, then they'll delay it, and that can mm-hmm. help. You know, that can be a problem too.
Yeah. Real quick, I know you've been monitoring some pieces of legislation. We'll pivot to the legislative process. In particular, House Bill number 675 on post-conviction relief. Where does that bill stand?
So that bill was released from House Appropriations yesterday morning. I'm very happy to report, and it will be debated, I think, this week on the House floor. Hopefully we can get it off the House floor and move it over to the Senate for more proceedings next week. It's an enormously important bill. Our post-conviction relief system is broken, and it's been, you know, it is a system that permits interminable delays, particularly in capital cases, and then everybody else's cases just sort of get kind of, they flounder in the system because of, you know, lack of counsel or lack of activity. But in capital cases, the game is delay. The longer they can delay action on post-conviction relief, the longer they can delay federal relief, and the longer they are able to avoid that penalty being carried out. So, you know, my mission is to make sure that we fix that system and we're able to move these cases forward.
Actually, I read through the bill for like the fourth time. And, you know, in a lot of cases, it was just cleaning up some of this. I don't even know how to characterize some of the language that it just left itself to broad interpretation and just utilizing a few. Actually being a lot more terse in many respects and just saying what it is that we're trying to accomplish here. You know,
well,
that,
and that's
that does away with the delays.
It does. And I think in some cases the law was clear. We just had to make it even more clear, and we had to give the state the ability to seek a remedy if a judge wasn't actually applying the law properly. Like, that's a problem in some of these cases. And so we need a relief valve and to be able to kind of bust it out from a judge who may not believe in the death penalty or just not, you know, want the case to move forward. And so I think, those are all issues that we needed solutions for in this rewrite. And the biggest problem that we have had in this system is that the lawyers were using shell petitions. And so they're filing basically an empty claim. You know, as a judge, really, if you don't brief your claims, then they ought to be dismissed. But they were using them to delay prescription running on the claim. And then they sit literally, I mean, sometimes for 10 or 12 years. In some cases, these cases have been in post-conviction relief for over 20 years. And they just sit there without filing a counseled petition.
Yeah, it's a joke. quite frankly.
It's and an it's abuse not because they the don't system. Have lawyers, by the way. They do have lawyers.
Yeah. Well, they have good lawyers that know how to abuse the system.
Right.
Let's be honest.
I mean, most and a lot of them have pro bono lawyers from some very large law firms. So, you know, it's not a situation where they aren't getting counsel. In a lot of these cases, in almost all of the capital cases, they not only have counsel appointed and paid for by the state of Louisiana, but they have outside counsel from very, very big pro bono national law firms.
Yeah, for sure. As always, we really appreciate your time, your insight. We know you're busy. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You are very welcome. Have a good week.
You too. That's Liz Muro, the Louisiana Attorney General. We'll be right back, folks. Stay.
College football summer is no time to slouch because we are taking you to school on the Cover 3 podcast, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. It's time for our annual summer school series as we take time to break down some of your favorite teams with experts and insiders who know these depth charts from top to bottom. But summer school is just extra credit as we go through positional drafts, player rankings, and more. Follow and listen to the Cover 3 podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
With us. Well, the sheriff says that she takes full accountability for what has happened today in her presentation before, or her testimony before the council this morning. I think what she means is she takes full responsibility for this mass breakout, which is a little bit of a different tone than what has been struck thus far since Friday. This has gone through multiple iterations. The attorney general looking in and investigating this, that they've been able to secure an arrest of an individual, Sterling Williams, age 33, was booked on 10 counts of principal to simple escape and one count of malfeasance in office. Obviously, this investigation will continue to reveal itself. This may not be the only individual. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, 200 officers assigned to trying to catch the escapees. 200. They have caught four thus far. Congratulations to them on that. It's great work. Six more to go. This is the outcome of when you're not minding the P's and Q's inside of this facility. That you end up costing people. The city the other day said they have a $70 million deficit. Well, guess what? It's probably going to be more than that because you're going to be paying a lot of more overtime to all of these agencies trying to catch these other individuals. We also heard from Laura Cannizzaro-Rodrigue. He made an interesting observation. Everyone's talking about their fear relative to these escapees. She said, try going down to criminal district court on Tuesday and see how many folks are being released with charges not being accepted and dropped, about how those victims and those witnesses feel. And nobody even calls them to tell them about this. They're having this horror over and over and over again. Kind of interesting, the revelations that have been made through this process. And there will be more to come. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Podcasting isn't just evolving. It's having a full-blown identity crisis. I'm Allison Marino, host of What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined, a new series that pulls back the curtain on the forces shaping the medium now and what that means for all of us who love podcasts. I'm really excited to share the official trailer where you'll hear from some of the biggest names in the space. Ira Glass, Leo Laporte, Guy Raz, Hernan Lopez, Lex Friedman, AJ Feliciano, Dan Granger, and yeah, me too. Here it is now.
I still want to kill the word podcast.
That's not just a hot take. It's a symptom of an identity crisis.
Big company run media, and people are trusting it less and less. It's really important that we're independent.
There's a handful of companies that control the vast majority of podcast inventory that have the vast majority of the gigantic shows.
We left radio behind for a reason. We wanted to get away from all the gatekeepers.
I don't know that you could do this as effectively in video.
Podcasting is at a crossroads. I've watched the industry swing from hype to consolidation to reinvention. But this time it's different. From the producers of the documentary Age of Audio, Oxford Road presents the Media Roundtable special series. What's a podcast? The revolution redefined.
All of us who work in the media, like, yeah, we got to run a business and like, we got to make a living and we got to sell our ads. We got to do all that. But we all got into it because like, I think most of us, like, it just gave us a feeling.
A three-part series where you'll hear the leading industry voices give their takes on what podcasting has become and where it's headed next. Teaming up with Oxford Road and Age of Audio director Sean Colon for this series was fun, but also kind of a wake-up call. If you love this medium as much as I do, you've got to listen to What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined. It's out now, wherever you get your podcasts.